for this conference will be the expose of the Sedevacanta's position. And I'd like to begin to show what we're going to be speaking about by telling you a story. It's a kind of an interesting story because of the fact that sometimes what you teach seminarians, you wonder if they're actually absorbing the material. And everyone's shaking their heads, yes and no, they understand. The seminarian come with me, and we were invited out to eat to a farmer family's home, and we were having dinner. And he starts to get into this
things about the existence of God and his essence, and he's getting into these deep theological things, and he's doing a butcher job of what I said in class. And I was just trying to get down low enough where I can kick him under the table, like, would you just stop? And he finally got the message when he was looking at my face, and I'm like, you don't bring that up now, and you're not really talking or explaining it well, so why don't you just leave it as it is? But nevertheless, I didn't want to leave people on a confused note, so I was about to say something, and the father of the family said, it's a shame those things happen, you know. And I mean, it was indicated in my mind from what he said, it went right over his head, and nobody understood what the seminarian said, so I figured just leave things as is. But what I wanted to say is that the topic that we have today is probably one that some of you are very familiar with, and there's others that are not so familiar with this topic. And so what I want to do is I want to cover this very, very thoroughly. I want to tell you what the opposition to the Sedevacantists, what they will say, and for that we'll have the transparencies. We'll take it right out of their magazines, right out of their publications. We'll give you the exact arguments that they use, and then we'll give an explanation how that is refuted and what our explanation for that is. As we know, we live in very confusing times. After Vatican Council II, an unprecedented situation existed in the church. We see things happening that were unheard of and unthinkable before. The man who claims to be the Pope worshiping with other religions. The Mass undergoing radical changes. The sacraments undergoing radical changes. Canon law being radically changed. Things that were in the past condemned, such as religious liberty, clearly condemned by Pope Pius IX in the Syllabus of Error, are now being promoted as church teaching. Clearly condemned in the past, such as in the Code of Canon Law, Canon 1258, the idea of worshiping, actively worshiping with other churches, with other religions, being condemned and now being promoted. Clearly, things that were held in the past to be, this is what the church teaches, there's no salvation outside the Catholic Church, there was one religion revealed by God, and now praises for other religions, the Hindus, the Buddhists, the Muslims, the Jews. In the past, there being the mission of the church to convert all nations to Christ, and now a new mission to acknowledge, preserve, and promote the good that's in other religions. In the past, before Vatican II, the Catholic Church saying there is but one true Church of Christ, and that is the Catholic Church. And now, after Vatican II, a new terminology that the true Church of Christ subsists in the Catholic Church, but it is not limited only to the Catholic Church. It exists outside the visible boundaries of the Catholic Church. Before Vatican II, it was forbidden, Canon 731 forbid, the giving of the sacraments to non-Catholics. They have to be converted back to the faith. They have to be received back into the church. Now the new code of canon law saying under certain circumstances, the Holy Eucharist can be given to Protestants. One of the conditions being they can't make it to their own Protestant minister. And John Paul II extending that permission to even include mixed marriages. So there are things that obviously have been very confusing. How could the church teach these things? How could the church legislate these things? How can the church present a liturgy that is so contrary to what the church had taught in the past? How do we reconcile these situations? very confusing times. So what I'd like to do is to cover this material as St. Thomas Aquinas covers in his Summa. He'll propose a question. He'll give the objections that are contrary to his opinion, and then he will refute those objections. Now, our point here is this. I really want you to understand that we're going to show you exactly what they teach, exactly what they say. And so, to begin with, among people, there is a Father Brian Harrison, and he taught a number of things. Get this screen back up again. He taught a number of things in the magazine called This Rock. Are any of you familiar with This Rock? Have you ever heard of it? It's more of an apologetic type magazine. Try to focus this here. Feature article, Can the Chair of Peter Be Vacant? And in this article, he makes some very interesting claims. And the one is here, White Smoke, Valid Pope. And I'm sorry if it's not as clear as it could be. But if you can see right here, he says a heretical pope would govern licitly, illicitly, unlawfully, but validly. Now, what is his argument to this point? You know, what you could do is maybe just put this on the floor, so because we're not going to be able to have a clear view of this. Just put the whole thing on the floor right there and point it diagonally. That would be fine. What is the issue that he's making here? Why does he say a heretical pope would illicitly reign, but not, but he would not be invalid. He would still be valid. His argument, Father Brian Harrison's argument, is this. I'm really limited here if this cord isn't there. Bring it this way. That way. It's trying to make life difficult for me. Sisters in the microphone here. Now we're not limited here. His argument goes as such. Number one, he says Pope Pius XII legislated for the election of popes that all penalties are lifted. In order to ensure a valid election. And therefore, he says that it wouldn't matter if someone were a heretic, schismatic. It wouldn't matter if they were a Freemason. They're still going to be elected because Pope Pius XII lifted all penalties. And what I'd like to do is to, if I can show you this quote here. Says here, the traditional law that chose Church goes out of its way to make possible for heretics, apostates, and Freemasons, among others, to be elected to the See of Peter. That's what he says. And I'd like to read to you from his article here. He quotes from Pope Pius XII. This is in the teaching of Pope Pius XII on the election of the Pope. None of the cardinals may in any way be, or under any pretext or reason of excommunication, suspension, or interdict whatsoever, or any other ecclesiastical impediment, be excluded from the active and passive election of the Supreme Pontiff. We hereby suspend such censures solely for the purpose of the said election. At other times, they are to remain in full vigor, but for the election, all penalties are lifted. So that's pretty much his argument in the nutshell. He goes on also to say this, to summarize the end of his article. He says, to sum it up then, the traditional and continuing law of the Church, expressed repeatedly in papal constitutions, allows for a heretical or apostate cardinal to participate fully in a papal conclave and even to be elected pope. If he could validly attain to papacy as a heretic and apostate, he could certainly retain it validly, even while remaining in that unhappy spiritual state. That's his first point. The second point is, a pope who began his pontificate as an Orthodox Catholic but became a formal heretic or apostate during his pontificate would thereby legally incur excommunication. However, even if his heresy or apostasy should become publicly discernible, the absence of any competent authority on earth who could lawfully declare his excommunication would mean that if he refused to resign or continue to insist on carrying out the acts of the papal authority, those acts, though illicitly exercised, would be valid. So these are the two arguments here. He says that Pope Pius XII lifted the penalties. And number two is that there is no one can declare him not the Pope. Now, I'm going to give credit where credit is due. Father Anthony Cicada took up the cause in this matter with Father Harrison and very succinctly refuted him. And the answer to the first point is this. We'll put it up on the screen here. What Pope Pius XII was lifting, and I know this is going to be hard for all of you to see, but what Pope Pius XII was lifting was ecclesiastical penalties, such as, let's say, one of the cardinals had a niece and he gave his niece money to have an abortion. He helped procure an abortion. He would be excommunicated. A penalty of that nature, when the cardinal goes into the conclave, is lifted. Or if a cardinal were to do something like, let's say, something really, really bad, like, break a secrecy that he's supposed to hold that is in his position under penalty of excommunication. When he goes into the conclave, that penalty is lifted. But when it comes to the matter of whether he's a member of the Catholic Church or not, that is not a matter of ecclesiastical law. That is a matter of divine law, God's law. In this Institutiones Juris Canonici, Coronata says, what is required by divine law for this appointment, also required for validity, is that the one elected be a member of the Church. Hence, heretics and apostates, at least public ones, are excluded. It cannot be proven, however, that the Roman pontiff as a private teacher cannot become a heretic. If, for example, he would contumaciously deny a previously defined dogma, such impeccability was never promised by God. Indeed, Pope Innocent III expressly admits such a case is possible. If indeed such a situation would happen, he, the Roman pontiff, would, by divine law, fall from office without any sentence, indeed, without even a declaratory one. He who openly professes heresy places himself outside the church, and it is not likely that Christ would preserve the primacy of his church in one so unworthy. Wherefore, if the Roman pontiff were to profess heresy before any condemnatory sentence, which would be impossible anyway, he would lose his authority. Morato in Institutionis Juris Canonici, 1921, heretics and schismatics are barred from the supreme pontificate by divine law itself. Now, why am I stressing divine law? Because that's God's law. The Pope cannot dispense from divine law, says this is not binding anymore. He can't. And that is exactly what Pope Pius XII, when you look at what he said, he's talking about ecclesiastical penalties. Excommunication, suspension, interdict. Whatever and any other ecclesiastical impediment. He's not talking about divine law. We also have below, De Ecclesia, given therefore the hypothesis of a pope who would become notoriously heretical, one must concede without hesitation that he would by that very fact lose the pontifical power, insofar as having become an unbeliever, he would by his own will be cast outside the body of the church. Now, I wanted to stress something right here, and that is that in the Code of Canon Law, 1917 Code, Canon 6, the first like 70 or 80 canons tell you how to interpret the Code of Canon Law. Canon 6 tells us all former disciplinary laws which were enforced until now, before the 1917 Code, and are neither explicitly or implicitly contained in the Code, shall be regarded as having lost all force, unless they are found in approved liturgical books, or they are laws derived from natural and the positive divine law. So even in the very beginning of canon law, to understand canon law, it's saying that the church is not doing away with divine law. That's God's law. God established that, and the church is not changing that at all. Now, there's another interesting thing. This is found in one of the decrees of an earlier pope. And this is debatable, but we're going to talk about all the ins and outs about this bull. But this was Pope Paul IV in 1559, cum ex apostolatus officio. Further, if ever it should appear that any bishop, even one acting as an archbishop, patriarch, or primate, or a cardinal of the Roman Church, or a legate, as mentioned above, or even the Roman pontiff, whether prior to his promotion as cardinal or prior to his election as Roman pontiff, has beforehand deviated from the Catholic faith or fallen into any heresy, we enact, decree, and determine and define such a promotion or election in and of itself, even with the agreement and unanimous consent of all the cardinals, shall be null, legally invalid, and void. And he goes on to say, it shall not be possible for such a promotion to be deemed valid or be valid, neither through reception of office, consecration, subsequent administration or possession, nor even through the putative, that means the outward enthronement of the Roman pontiff himself, together with the veneration and obedience accorded him by all. Such promotion or election shall not through any lapse of time in the foregoing situation be considered even partially or legitimate or in any way. Each and all those words as acts, laws, appointments of those so promoted or elected, and indeed whatsoever flows therefrom shall be lacking in force and shall grant no stability or legal power to anyone whatsoever. Those so promoted or elected by that very fact and without the need to make any further declaration shall be deprived of any dignity, position, honor, title, authority, office, and power. Now, some may call into question, saying, well, this is not found in the Code of Canon Law, so therefore this is no longer binding. Well, two answers to that. First and foremost, I would repeat that what Pope Paul IV is saying here is basically he's repeating that it's of divine law that heretics, apostates, public ones cannot be elected to the papacy. That's all he's repeating. And so some may argue, well, this is no longer found in the Code of Canon Law, this bull of Pope Paul IV, so it's no longer binding. But the point I would like to reiterate is this, as we showed you before, the Code of Canon Law says all former disciplinary laws which were enforced until now and are neither explicitly nor implicitly contained in the Code shall be regarded as having all lost all force unless they are found in approved liturgical books or they are laws derived from the natural and the positive divine law. And as these theologians are saying, in order to be elected to the papacy, in order to be the head of the church, you have to be a member of the church. The other thing I'd like to say is this. Now, this really gets into some fine print here. But this is right out of the Latin Code of Canon Law. There's a Canon 188, and it talks about the tacit renunciation of someone's office. If you do any one of these things, ipso facto, by that fact, without a declaration being necessary, which is found right here, sine ulla decorazione, decorazione, what happens, you automatically forfeited your position. And this we find right here in number 4. A fide cattolica publice de feceret. If he publicly defects from the Catholic faith. Now what's interesting is, just to get a real quick summary of how canon law came to be, the 1917 code, Pope St. Pius X, in his wisdom, he saw that there were so many different sources of church law. You had 200 and some odd popes, you had 20 ecumenical councils, you had traditional laws, you had all these different sources of law. The study of the church's laws were very cumbersome. And he said, we need to put it into one volume. And so he established a commission to do that very thing. Now, what's interesting in this Canon 6, they're basically saying that to whatever degree this 1917 code of law is repeating an old law from a pope or a council of the church or whatever, if it's repeating it entirely, then the interpretation is brought back to when that was decreed by the pope or the council. If it's only found in part, that the 1917 code is only repeating a part of the old law, then you interpret that law according to that part that is still found in the code. If any laws that were in the past are not found in this 1917 code, then they're abolished. But when it comes to the divine law, it doesn't touch. This code does not touch the divine law. But what's interesting is, on this canon 188, number 4, defecting from the faith, now if I'm looking at canon law, if I'm studying canon law, I'm going to say, okay, I see what these teach, but I want to get the interpretation of this. How do I understand what the church is teaching here? And that's the reason why in the Latin code, you have these footnotes there. And this is, you know, this pope, that council, this teaching, whatever. Very interesting as a footnote to this canon 188, and I know this is really small writing, but we have here Pope Paul IV, cum ex apostolatus, February 15th, 1559. So my point is that when people say, well, the cum ex apostolatus officio is not found in the Code of Canon Law, it is found in the Code of Canon Law under canon 188. And not only that, but I'd also reiterate that this is referring to divine law. Someone who is not a member of the church cannot be the head of the church. What's interesting is Father Brian Harrison I think he was really checkmated by Father Chicada. And what I'd like to do, I set out a number of what articles I'd like to recommend. Father Chicada, very succinctly, Father Harrison, Heresy and Sedevacantism. Excellent article. It's not copyrighted. And it says right to receive free newsletter, but it's, you can certainly reprint this to your heart's content. So after this conference, if any of you like a copy, maybe we just have a sheet of paper down here in front of each of these papers. And what you can do is you can write your name down and one copy or whatever. We'll make photocopies for you. I think this is very apropos because Father Chicada goes into a lot more detail than I have the time to do right now. He says Father Harrison would try to make some claims about heresy that it has to be so blatant that the whole church recognizes it. And Father Chicada says, no, that's not the teaching of the church. And the other point that Father Harrison tries to come up with is the idea that no one can declare him not the Pope. And that gets into a very interesting topic, which we're going to get into a little bit further on, and that is where Pope Innocent III himself says, no one can judge me unless I defect from the faith. And there is going to be theologian after theologian after theologian who say, yes, no one judges this first see of Peter. No one can judge it. However, if he defects from the faith, he's already judged by God. And the church, all that it is making, recognizing the fact that he has deposed himself. And like I say, we're going to get into that. But I wanted to run through these two particular points. Also, it's interesting, too, St. Alphonsus Liguori speaks of this as well. It matters not that in the past century some pope was illegitimately elected or was fraudulently intruded into the pontificate. It is enough that he was afterwards accepted as pope by the whole church, since by such acceptation he then became legitimate and true pope. Now, he's not, St. Alphonsus Liguori is not contradicting the bull of Pope Paul IV, because Pope Paul IV is talking about heresy. And this is going to be a very important distinction that we're going to make. I can give you oodles and oodles of quotes of theologians who say, if the Pope gives you a sinful command, he wants you to go murder somebody, he wants you to take all the money out of the church treasury and give it to his relatives, if he wants you to buy and sell ecclesiastical positions, the Pope as an individual can commit sin. He's not impeccable. But it is impossible for the Pope to issue a universal law, a law to the universal church that is contrary to faith and morals. And so, you know, this is the whole part of the problem. Some people will pick on a quote from St. Robert Bellarmine or Cajetan or whatever, and they're not understanding there's distinctions that need to be made. And those distinctions are the Pope as an individual can commit sin. The Pope as an individual can command you to do something that's sinful, and you have the right to disobey him. But when the Pope speaks as the Pope, when he's teaching a universal church, when he's especially giving a universal law, that is protected by the infallibility of the church. And so we're talking about two different things. In the case of St. Alphonsus Liguori here, if someone were to fraudulently intrude himself into the pontificate, you know, try to get votes, let's say, you know, one cardinal pulls a sleeve up and puts in 20 votes for himself or something like that, those types of things, is enough that afterwards, it was afterwards accepted as pope by the whole church. Since by such acceptation, he then became a legitimate and true pope. But if for some time he was not really accepted universally by the church, in such case, the pontifical see was vacant during that time, as it is vacant at the death of a pope. Again, it matters not that in the case of schism, that there should be for a considerable time doubt as to who is the true pope, since one would then be the true pope even though he were insufficiently known as such, and if none of the rivals were true pope, then the pontificate would simply be vacant. Now, what is he talking about there? We've talked about this in past conferences, but during the Western Schism, when there are three men claiming to be pope at one time, you had, for political reasons, a division between Rome and Avignon and Pisa. This lasted for about 40 years. It wasn't necessarily what we would say a schism in the true sense of the word. Truly, no one was denying the papacy. They were certainly recognizing the papacy. They were just not sure who the true pope was. And here again, this is what St. Alphonsus Liguori is teaching. But what's also interesting, he says, some have sought to prove that certain popes fell into heresy. But in this, they have never succeeded and will never succeed, and we shall prove the direct contrary in the 10th chapter. I remember meeting this one fellow from the Society of St. Pius X, who was going to try to show me that what's happening in the church today has certainly happened in the past. Honorius, Liberius, John the 22nd. I said, you don't even know what you're talking about. At Vatican Council I, these issues had come up and they were all sufficiently refuted. And we're going to get into that, like I say, as time goes on. But the interesting thing is that Cardinal Manning, who was at Vatican I, he mentions explicitly in his book on the Vatican Council, he says, this idea of Honorius being a heretic is ridiculous. It has been sufficiently refuted time and time again. Same thing with Liberius. Same thing with John the 22nd. So there are going to be some out there who are going to try to say this and that and whatever else. Those are all, it's never been proven. And that's the point to be made. They're trying to claim that these men were heretics and still remain pope. Okay. What I wanted to do is read to you a letter, but I'm going to show it on the screen here. And this goes into a particular area. This is really small print, and I apologize. I wish we could get this blown up or whatever. If I could move this screen back a little bit, we might be able to get a bigger picture, but I don't think we're only limited here. But this is a priest, a Father John Peek. He's from Massachusetts. And, Your Reverence, where can the four marks of the Catholic Church be found today? Your position statement on the CMRI website, number 4, states that today's Catholic Church has lost the marks of unity and holiness. Well, it's not what we say. We're trying to say the conciliar church, not the Catholic Church, but the conciliar church does not have these marks. Since we declare with the Nicene Creed that we believe in one Holy Catholic Apostolic Church and recite it in the present tense, and believe that these are the marks by which the one true Church of Christ is identified, these four marks must exist today. But if they can no longer be found in Rome, then where? Isn't it de fide that Rome is the one place where the four marks will always be found? Furthermore, aren't the four marks to be perpetual in the same manner as from the beginning as taught by Pope Pius XI in Mortalium Animos? Hence, not only must the Church still exist today and continue always to exist, but it must ever be exactly the same as it was in the days of the Apostles. Otherwise, we must say, which God forbid, that Christ has failed in his purpose and that he erred when he asserted of his Church that the gates of hell should never prevail against it. Another important question needs to be asked. If there is no successor to Peter for 48 years, then there must not be any successors to the Apostolic College empowered to organize and govern a certainly valid election to the throne of St. Peter in order to fulfill this canon from Vatican Council I. If anyone then says that it is not from the institution of Christ the Lord himself, or by divine right that the blessed Peter has perpetual successors in the primacy of the universal church, or that the Roman pontiff is not the successor of Blessed Peter in the same primacy, let him be anathema. How can the succession be perpetual If all the electors and those with the power and jurisdiction to order, organize, govern, and certify a valid election have no successors. I know of no meaning of the word perpetual that allows for an indefinite interruption or the necessity for Christ to return and replace and place the church back upon the rock of Peter.